On this episode of Autographs.
And it's not going to be right in front of you, because that's by virtue what the purpose of life is, to experience. You know, we go out there and we have all these different experiences, and we find the experiences that we align with, and we find the experiences that we don't. And then we find this flow, and then all of a sudden we go, oh my God, I think I've found the thing that I meant to do. Great. Now how do you live that purpose?
Hey everybody, this is Nick Singh, and you are now listening to Autographs. You know, when you stop looking for acceptance and you just enjoy your life, the whole game changes.
You have to understand yourself. Like, and I think the real answer is real giving. Is that I don't understand why people don't get that if you give purely, you get.
We get good at what we do the most of. You nurture the process of like going to yourself and listening to yourself, and you get very good at honing your own intuition.
Did I actually make people stop and go, whoa, humans are capable of more than I thought? You're great at a certain skill, and you can then put that skill to use to help somebody else. That's fulfillment.
My hope is that this show inspires you to just feel like you can just be yourself, have fun, and enjoy your life too. So enjoy and take care out there.
The amount of times that I've done shows, I once had the founder of Lululemon on, and there was just so many technical errors that we couldn't post it. So now I just like, I'm almost antsy about recording. So I just started recording, but we can cut all this stuff at the beginning. But do you watch TV, man? Hey, that's
man, I consume an enormous amount of content. I love content, movies, TVs, documentaries. I love content in all shapes and creating content, consuming content. They say rich people have small TVs and big libraries. I have a fucking massive library and a huge TV, so I don't know what that makes me.
That is what I fucking love to hear, man. We are cut from the same cloth. What time? So I'm always confused. We actually just hired our first hire from Australia 2 weeks ago, nice. Actually. She's lovely. And so I'm just for the first time ever getting acquainted with Australian time. So are
it's
you
9:05 a.m., brother?
So you're plus 12. She's plus 15, oddly enough. So she must be in a different place.
So
in
she's
Australia.
In Queensland.
Yeah.
Oh, no, she could be in WA. Yeah, Western Australia. That is a couple of hours on top.
Yeah, so it's always
neat. And I'm literally half an hour from the Queensland border. So we have a 1 hour time difference, and that fucks me up every day of the week.
Are you in, where are you? Are you in Sydney?
I'm in Byron Bay.
Okay. Where is that in Australia? Is that south? Is that
Northern New South Wales, most famous for our most famous resident, which is Chris Hemsworth. It's just a beautiful coastal beach town, originally founded by hippies, artists, and musicians. Have you been to Maui at all?
I wish, but I have not.
There's a great little city in Maui, a little town in Maui called Lahaina. It reminds me a lot of Lahaina. So it's a little coastal town, but it's been taken over by Hollywood in the last 12 months. So it's not exactly the same town it used to be.
Yeah. No, I get that, man. I get that. That's beautiful, though. That's beautiful. Have you ever run? I also come from, it sounds like almost like a little quaint place. Out of curiosity, have you ever run into like Chris Hemsworth or anybody like that? Or no? Is it small enough to do that?
When I first moved to Byron, he was my next door, like literally my next door neighbor for the first 12 months. He's got a house over in Broken Head. Yeah. And he's got a surf house in Suffolk Park. So he lived right smack next door. So I'd see him, would say g'day every morning when he'd go out for a surf when he was in town, or if he wasn't in his Broken Head property. He's a lovely guy. Everyone loves him except for some of the locals who think that he's attracted the wrong type into the town, but he's a great guy. Like, he's soul to the earth. His boys, Aaron and Zocco, the guys he hangs out with, his personal trainer and his PA are mates that he's had since childhood. So he's a really, a salty dog, you know, soul to the earth and friendly to everybody.
I love that. A salty dog. I am ready to unleash all the Australian lingo on today's show. I can't wait. I'm sure you got a taste for the West too, man. But listen, let's flip it on its head a little bit. I love making these conversational. I feel like there's all too many shows out there at the moment that are just, they're just so Q&A. And I'll give you some context as to who I am as we go through. And I'm just looking forward, man. I mean, this has been a long time coming, and I have a little bit of a show sheet here that we'll follow as a rough guideline. But beforehand, let's flip it on its head. Let's do a little rapid fire. So, and this should load you guys up with fun content too. We recently did this with a client of mine, and he's very in your space. He's got a lot of content that's businessy, entrepreneurial, motivational, life help. And we did this one word answers thing, and the clip did really well. So it was just a lot of fun. So I figured that I'd give you the same benefit, and I thought it would be fun. So, okay. So here's the rule. Okay. I'm going to ask you a question or say a word and you can only respond in one word. Is that fair?
Love it. Yeah. Okay, done. Cool.
All right. So it's 5:08 my time right now. It's 9:08 your time. We're cutting it at 5:10. So we got 2 minutes roughly. Here we go. Let's start nice and easy. I'm reading them off my phone. Texting or talking?
Texting.
Favorite day of the week?
Sunday.
First celebrity crush?
Ooh, god damn. I'd say Jennifer Garner.
Ooh. Favorite number?
8.
Do you believe in fate?
Yes.
Movies or books?
Movies.
Wow. Movies or TV shows?
Movies.
Wow. Okay. Marvel or DC?
Marvel.
There we go. You're on point with your Christopher Hemsworth right there. No, that's not a good one. Godfather or Star Wars?
Oh, Star Wars.
Okay. Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
All right. Let's just go with one word now. It's 5:09. Funeral. First word that comes to mind.
Familia.
Okay. I like that. Current song you're listening to?
Ooh, Man on a Mission.
Oh, that's a banger by Ode Larceny. That's a really great track. All right. Boom, 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 boom. Let's make this fun. Okay. Damn, I'm running short. Okay. Let's go with, you know what? I'm out. I'm fresh out of the tank, man. I'm fresh out of the tank. It's 5:10. So let's can it there. But that was fun. So the first thing I want to do here, Kerwin, is just acknowledge you, man. Like I see your posts on my feed often. And it's hard for me to, and I'll speak candidly to, and this doesn't just go for you. Every now and again, as a little bit of background to me, I'm 25. I'll go to an event. It'll be a Tony Robbins event or it'll be to a conference. And these things have changed my life. It's flipped my life on its head, which is why I love being able to do what I do and make the impact that I can. And without mistake, every single time that I go, I leave being reminded of like the spirit of love and the spirit of just togetherness and community. And then as the sun rises in the morning and the moon sets at night, or the moon rises at night, I always forget. I always lose touch with that as life happens. And then I'll see content from Tony or Tom Bilyeu or yourself or Gary or whomever it may be. And I'll just judge it. I'll be like, oh, this is corny. And then I'll be reminded of like the loving spirit that I was reminded of at the event that is like a non-judgmental spirit. And I've noticed a pattern that it's the real communicators and orators of today who are speaking so truly and purely from their heart and souls that are able to bring me back into what I feel is like the truth so quickly. And you've been one of those people, man. Absolutely love your content. I think that you're one of the most gifted communicators that I've actually come across. You're deeply speaking from the heart. You're very unplanned yet so real and well-spoken. And I just love what you do. So my first question for you actually was going to be, what is it you do? How would you define what it is you do?
Yeah, that's, first of all, thanks, Matt. I appreciate the love. It's always nice to hear it. Mate, I struggle with that question. In fact, I hate that question, but, depending on the day of the week and where I'm at, normally it's either I'm an ass model for Calvin Klein, which is a nice way to break the ice. It normally gets people laughing. And then I say, if I walked in backwards, you would not be laughing. But look, I consider myself someone who is obsessed with performance. And I apply that obsession, in the area of business, in the area of sport, in the area of parenting, in any area really where I kind of take interest. I guess you could say when I first got obsessed with performance, my main duty or my main application was in the area of business. I grew up not having a lot of money. Voids breed values, or they tend to do that anyway. And so, I decided to, solve all of my wounds and heal all of my issues and, essentially become an entrepreneur and learn how to make a lot of money. And so I applied everything I knew towards the act of growing businesses quickly. And over a period of time, I developed a real specialty. And my specialty, like my commercial specialty, is I am really good at growing businesses very fast. I would classify myself as a fast growth specialist. You know, a lot of that is pinned down by the fact that I'm ADHD, and if things don't move quickly, I get bored fast. And so by virtue of, you know, me getting into business and not really learning how to take authority well in a job, I had no choice but to learn how to make things work. And then over time, I started sharing that knowledge with other people, with friends, and those friends started making a lot of money. And then I started, you know, providing that information to other clients and then consulting. And yeah, I kind of, I guess you could say, to fill into it. But along the way, ever since I can remember, I've always been obsessed with human performance. And so for me, I just love, I love the fact that anyone can change. I love the fact that, you know, I can be who I am today, and 10 years from now, you're not going to be able to recognize me, even though, you know, we're both in pretty good spots right now. And yeah, I'm someone that has created an enormous amount of change in my own life, and I use that as a template to overlay on other people's lives who, you know, who seek change.
It's really beautifully worded. I know some of your history in business, but and we might be able to get there in the hour that we have, but what feels most important to me and most potent about your message is the fact that everything comes down to your human psychology and the way that you see the world. I've always felt in my heart that that's just where change really is. And it's not unique that I think that. It's just really beautiful to see how widely you represent it. But the reason why I asked you is because I have my own inner troubles with this whole ability around helping people. It's so easy, man. I'm sure you know. That's why I just commend your spirit so well to have gotten to where you gotten have. It's so easy to get into your head when, like, you're the person sharing content and you're the person sharing information that's there to help people. And I've always had this battle within me wherein when somebody goes, okay, what's your purpose? And in some way, shape, or form, everybody's purpose lines up to be really similar next to one another. It has usually something to do in a pure sense with helping another person. And there's 50 million ways to word that, but it always has to do with something like that. So it's always like, I want to inspire other people. I want to help others. And I feel that that's pure. That's for me. That's for others, et cetera. That being said, the next question then is, okay, well, what's your preferred way of doing that? Right? Like, how do you self-express in a way that just feels honest and true and real, in a way where you're just wholesomely thinking about the other person on the other side of the screen, other side of the stage, other side of the conversation, whatever the case may be. And my question for you, Kerwin, is how do you stay out of your head and in your heart during that process? Because I almost back it up a bit and I'll say, well, I've told myself at times that my purpose is to help other people find theirs. And I hear that a lot, man. I hear that so much at like a personal development. I'm speaking to the king, man. So like, here, let's either call bullshit on that now, saying, listen, whoever says that, including you, Nick, at some points has the game a little bit twisted. Or do you feel that there's merit to that out of curiosity? Because if your purpose is to help other people find theirs, I almost have felt internally, this is my own limiting belief to anybody listening, that it almost feels like a cop-out. Do you identify with that?
Yeah, look, I can relate to what you're saying, because, you know, a purpose is a very personal thing, and helping someone find their purpose is like, you know, helping a grown man put on their underpants. You know, you can help someone do that, but at the same time, the best way to help someone find their purpose is to support them in their own discovery, in their own adventure. You know, and I say that, you know, often I say finding your purpose is like finding your favorite ice cream. You know, if you go to Baskin Robbins, there's 54 flavors, I think, in the shop, but most people will only ever try, you know, maybe 3 or 4 flavors, and they'll settle on the one that they think they like because, well, I like vanilla, I like, you know, salted caramel, I like white chocolate, and so I like the vanilla salted white caramel, you know? The way I think we can support people in a pure way with the discovery of their purpose is to encourage people to try lots of ice cream. And I don't mean that in the literal context, you know,
go and get
metaphoric.
Go and try fucked on ice cream.
I had 48 different jobs, Nick, before I found what I'm doing. You know, I started working at the age of 13 before I was even legally allowed to be employed. And so, you know, in many ways I feel very grateful because I got to do a lot of different things, and I got to find out very quickly there were things that I really liked and the things that I really didn't like. You know, I really didn't like, although I enjoyed physical labor, I didn't enjoy doing it for 6-7 days a week. You know, I enjoyed working as a cook and working at Sizzler, although I didn't enjoy being, you know, screamed at and yelled at by, you know, other people in intense situations and by management, you know. So I think when we support people to find purpose, as long as we're doing it from the perspective of not spoon feeding it, you know, because I think that's oftentimes where people go wrong, is they try to, well, hang on, let's sit down and create your purpose. So what do you love to do? And they write it out for them. They go, wow, I found your purpose. And then they read it and go, well, yeah, that sounds good. It's like, well, a purpose doesn't have to sound good. You know, a purpose isn't supposed to be on a business card. It's something that you do. And, you know, finding your purpose, living your purpose, and realization of potential of purpose. They're two completely different things, because first of all, we've got to find it, right? And that in itself is the most important part of the journey, because you've got to look, and it's not going to be right in front of you, because that's by virtue what the purpose of life is, to experience. You know, we go out there and we have all these different experiences, and we find the experiences that we align with, and we find the experiences that we don't. And then we find this flow, and then all of a sudden we go, oh my God, I think I found the thing that I meant to do. Great. Now, how do you live that purpose? And because anyone could go, well, I love to help people. Great. But now it'd be really easy for you to, Nick, to live your purpose every single day. You
exactly.
can literally walk into any major city and just walk up to every single homeless person or any, you know, any shelter, and you can fucking help your heart out. But I don't know, man, you might have bills to pay. You might need to put food on the table. You know, you might need to have a family that you have to provide for. You might even have medical bills for yourself or other people. You might be responsible for caring for other people. So what I've learned is finding your purpose is the hardest thing, because that's what requires the most amount of discipline, the most amount of resilience, the most amount of work to just go and, you know, get in the mud and discover things. Once you find your purpose, then it's very difficult, because people go, well, I want to live my purpose, but I need a job. I need to pay for what I do. And say, okay, so how do you then realize the potential of your purpose? And to me, the realization component is, how do you live your purpose, you know, in a way where you actually get, you know, compensated for that? And that's where I think most people really fall down, because they go, well, I'd really love to help people, but, you know, I'm just a janitor. And it's like, well, hang on a second. You can help people and you can still be a janitor at the same time. Because after all, I don't know about you, but I love to sit on a clean toilet, and I find that really helpful to walk into a, you know, into a toilet in a public place and find a really, that's helpful for me. And I, you know, if I have to sit down and wipe down the toilet for my son or for myself, or if I have to, you know, go to three or four toilets because they're full of shit, that's not helpful for me. And so for me, you know, I think living purpose or realizing purpose for the most part is a simple shift in perspective to go, how am I living my purpose already? And how can I live the greatest version of my potential? And so if you identify that you love to help people and whatever you do, first of all, how do you do that? And how does that exist in what you do already? But then how do you realize that? And for me, you know, I realized that I love to help people. And that's the way I discovered my purpose, Nick, was really quite straightforward. At the age of like 28, 29, I sat down and I thought, what is the most consistent theme in my life, going as far back as I can remember? You know, and the theme that was consistent in my life is, although I didn't have a lot of friends at school or otherwise, I used to attract a lot of people who would come to me and talk about their problems at school. I used to have a lot of kids that would come and talk to me about the problems with their families or problems with boyfriends or girlfriends or problems they were having personally.
And ain't nothing, to me that guy, nothing's changed. Ain't nothing's
yeah,
changed.
Yeah, not a lot has changed.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I looked at where I had the most fun, when I looked at where I lost time and space, it was in situations where I was helping people. And so for me, I feel quite lucky because I found my purpose in my late 20s. But then the realization of my purpose, I realized, well, I can help one person one-on-one. And I found that very, you know, very enjoyable. But then I was like, I need to help more people. And that was when the realization of potential comes in. It was like, how do I help people at scale? You know, how do I go from working with one person at a time to 10 people at a time, to 100 people at a time, you know, to 500 people at a time, to 1,000 people at a time? And that for me is where we get into the realization.
So, okay. I know I kind of raised my hand there to almost interrupt you, but I meant it from my heart, because I really want to key in on this, because I think this is where I know I struggle, and I've really tried. Have you ever seen the show Boy Meets World? Was that popular in Australia?
I think I saw it. Boy Meets World. It sounds familiar.
It was like it was a young show of like a boy growing up. It was really just heartfelt, wholesome show I used to watch as a kid, and I recently rewatched. So many beautiful life lessons in it. I feel like your kids would love it, man. They would love it. It's gorgeous. They might not appreciate the way it was like filmed, because it's like freaking horrible quality in contrast to what you get now. But nonetheless, is this really beautiful journey of like a boy growing up. So I say, you know, I get a chance to interface with these folks like yourself, and I want to do right by anybody who takes the time to listen. And I said, the best way I can do that is just to be honest, vulnerable, and forthcoming, and say that my North Star with these conversations is that whatever resonates with me, I believe wholesomely it'll resonate with other 20-somethings, because I found in my life that the experiences that we all go through really similar things. And the next thing I'm about to say resonates with me, and it was about what you just said. So your purpose is largely to help people in a conversational format. I struggle with this, what I'm about to say next. And I wonder if you did and how you got over it. And I've actually met many people who do struggle with this as well. I will actually send this particular clip to a few friends afterward, because I think that your answer is going to be profound. I hope it is. But when you found that for yourself, Kerwin, no pressure, man, no pressure. It's my West Coastness. But when you found that for yourself, that you're There was an actor once on Tim Ferriss that described it as God's presence showed up when he was on stage and when he was performing. And it feels like, to me, for you, I can use similar verbiage, that God's presence was felt when you were engaging and like just helping somebody through their challenges in life. And it's still so beautifully what you get a chance to do to today, life, business, etc. What became the active ingredient in your life to activate that? Meaning, and I'll make this simple. How did you engage in the lessons yourself so that you can then pass those truths on to other people?
Great question. I worked on myself.
Okay, interesting.
Like, well, let's tackle one question at a time, because this is a really big one and it deserves its own space. You know, because people often ask me, like, man, you know, you talk about so many different things. You know, I talk about everything from parenting to health to PTSD, addiction, ADHD, dyslexia, you know, a range of other mental health issues and relationship issues. And, you know, people often say, well, how is it that you are able to talk to so many different aspects of life? And I go, well, dude, I've lived a lot of life. And I don't mean that in a sense that I've lived a bigger or a better life than anyone else. But I grew up with a kid who, you know, who had a lot of problems, you know, single, born to a single mom on a pension. My parents split up when I was 6 months old.
Me too.
So yeah. So as you understand, I grew up without a very solid father figure, but the desire for a father figure at the age of 8, my mom finally met a man who, she intended to marry. He got beaten to death, in his hotel room.
He got beat to death?
He did. And so I experienced, you know, I guess you could say a severe level of trauma at a very early age. At the age
of 15. So sorry to hear that.
Mate, it is what it is. And, you know, it was an important part of my journey. At the age of 15, I had my first of 7 near-death accidents where I fell over on a broken bottle. And I've got some pretty gnarly scars. I don't know if you can see here. From one starts here, goes all the way down here. Another one that starts up here, goes down here, and then all the way down here.
Wow.
Cut all my nerves, all my tendons, main artery. You know, 30 and a half hours of microsurgery. 2 blood transfusions later, I was told that I'd be lucky to get 20% use of my hand back, and I'd be disabled. You know, compound that with the fact that I was diagnosed at 8 with ADHD, dyslexia. I was told I was learning disabled. I failed every single subject, Nicholas, from year 1 all the way through to year 12. And so every 3 months I was reminded very, very vividly of how stupid that I was, you
wow.
know, and how I was not, you know, of this cloth that was everyone else seemed to be a part of. And, you know, so therefore I had to, you know, every 3 months I had to basically cop it from the teacher. When it came to the report card, then I'd have to go home and I'd cop it from my mum, and then I'd cop it from my dad because they lived separately. And everyone kind of got used to me being a bit of a failure. And, you know, then I moved out of home at the age of, I think it was about 15 and a half, 16. And, you know, I started fending for myself. And then by 18, I was working in, the security industry. And I was a competitive athlete in, you know, in weightlifting and bodybuilding. And, you know, I'd been a competitive athlete in the fight sports. And so I was very large and I was very able to handle myself. And so for the next 4.5 years, I was navigating, you know, some of the most violent venues in Southeast Queensland. And I got, you know, I had one mate that was shot dead on the door. I had another mate that was stabbed in the heart and who died in front of me. You know, I've been shot at. I've had a gun put in my mouth. I've been stabbed. I've got 10, which you can't really see. I've got 10 scars that travel my face that you can't see. I've been hit in the head with a 4x2 that had a screw going. I've actually got a dent that actually runs down the side of my skull here. I've got no sensation on the top of my head because I had a glass smashed across my face. And so, you know, fast forward, you know, into my early 20s, I developed complex PTSD, you know, and a range of other, you know, and by 19, I was addicted to amphetamines. And so by 22, you know, I had a lot of baggage, and I continually to acquire baggage up until probably my mid 20s and even beyond. Yeah, because that's the thing about baggage is, you know, once we have a bag, you know, we might put a bit of baggage out, but we always try and stuff it. You know, it's like when you go on holidays and you go on a shopping holiday, you know, you often try and stuff as much possibly you can because you don't want to deal with it. You just want to carry it with you everywhere. And so, you know, I ended up in my mid-20s as a kid who just had, you know, complex PTSD and addiction issues and relationship issues and learning disabilities. And I was just like, man, there's got to be a better way. And I started working on myself, and the work started a lot earlier. The work started, you know, I was very lucky. I was born, my mum was a clairvoyant and a psychic. My dad was an economist. And so I was exposed to a lot of new age content from a very early age, but I didn't really start doing the real work. And look, I started reading books when I was about 23, 24. And I still remember the first book I read. It was called The Magic of Thinking Big by Dr. David Schwartz.
Great book.
And great book. Very basic, you know, reframing book. And up until that point, and this is an important part of my story, I'd never read a book cover to cover. You know, I'd never read a book. I had to read books for school projects, but I'd read the first paragraph 50 times and never get any further. You know, I'd read the first line at least 100 times. And because I couldn't retain information. I had real trouble reading because of my dyslexia. And so as a result, I never read a book. And it wasn't that I couldn't read. I just didn't realize I was reading things I wasn't interested in. And, you know, I didn't realize that ADHD and dyslexia are actually superpowers when they're framed the right way. And at the age of 23, I pick up a book that I'm actually interested in because I had a whole bunch of problems and I wanted to solve them. And then all of a sudden I start reading this book and I finish this book within about 3 to 5 days. And I remember looking at the back page of this book after I finished it and I was like, and because I'd been labeled stupid, and that was a label that I had grabbed onto. You know, the joke was Kerwin could lift 100, but he can't count that high. You know, and so by the time I'm 23, I didn't think I was intelligent at all. Like I literally thought I was stupid. And I don't say that as I kind of thought I was stupid. No, I was convinced I was stupid. I was convinced I had no very low levels of intelligence and all I had was athletic ability. And then all of a sudden I read this book and I get to the end of this book and I'm like, holy shit, I can remember what I read. And not only can I remember what I read, I'm actually inspired to read more. And since then I've read about 1200 books. And you know, for some people that's a lot, you know, but there's other people like Dee Martini who's read like 35,000 texts. And so, you know, since then I've gone on, you know, for the, and you say books or movies. I love movies, but I also love books, but I don't read science fiction. I don't read fiction. The only, if you look at my library, it's 1200 books full of, you know, psychology, biology, persuasion, addiction, quantum mechanics, particle physics, theoretical physics. And so for me, you know, I guess you could say over that period of the last 23, 24 years, I just really started to investigate myself first, healing myself. And through the process of healing myself, I'm someone who's very process orientated and I like to know what I did. And so I'm not someone that'll go and do something and go, oh, you know, that was really nice. I healed myself. And people say, what do you do? Well, I kind of did a bit. Like I document everything I would do to go through my processes. You know, I've done everything from psychiatry, talk therapy, psychedelic therapy, MDMA therapy. Like I've done, Tony Robbins. I've done a lot of different stuff. You know, skydiving therapy, Navy SEALs therapy. You know, I did a lot of.
You did fucking Navy SEALs. I haven't even heard of that. That's.
Well, it's not really a therapy, but you know, for me, I confront things that are fearful. You know, we're only born with three basic fears: loud noises, falling, and the fear of abandonment. And so, you know, I became an avid skydiver. I did 200 skydives. I used to strap heart rate monitors onto myself in free fall and meditate in free fall to get my heart rate under 80 beats a minute to prove it was possible, which
did you do it?
Yeah, many times. You know, the reason I trained with the Ukrainian Special Forces and the Navy SEALs and I had a fascination with weapons as a kid is because whenever you, and I don't know if you've ever shot off or if you've ever, you know, used weapons before or percussion instruments, when they let off their percussion, when they let off the loud sound, that activates your autonomic nervous system without you even wanting it to. And, you know, what I found really impressive about whether it be Navy SEALs or, you know, any form of spec ops is their ability to be able to perform highly complex processes, very complex processes. Like just, you know, you look at, you know, two guys going through a kill house or doing a plane hostage situation. They go, oh, wow, that looks really exciting. But what you don't see is you don't see the thousands or in the most cases, the hundreds or the thousands of hours that have gone into practicing that with live ammunition to be able to practice process while you've got munitions that are actually being fired and your systems are being activated and you have to regulate that and maintain perspective and coherence and process information and physical process at the same time and not kill your buddy, you know? And so for me, you know, that was an important part of me conquering fear and the fear of abandonment. And, you know, that's where I've spent a lot of time by myself. You know, I've done a lot of in deep internal work. There's, you know, many different forms of meditation. There's one that's called Vipassana where you know, it's a silent retreat. You go away, you take a vow of silence. You can't talk to anyone. You can't look at anyone. You know, they separate the men and the women and you're meditating from 4:30 in the morning till 9:30 at night and you break for morning, you know, for breakfast and lunch. I did that 7 times, you know? And so I had one person say, man, that must've been really lonely. And I was like, well, it probably would be if you didn't know who you were. If you didn't have a relationship with yourself, it'd be lonely as fuck. But when you spend enough time with yourself, you get to know yourself. And as you get to know yourself, you get to know where your buttons are. You get to know what your wounds are. So when you know what your wounds are, you can find ways to heal them. And if you know where you've got rust, you can go and cut it out. Okay. But first of all, you've got to know where the rust is. And then you've got to, read the book on how do I cut out rust and repair it? And there's plenty of books out there to teach you how to heal, but you've got to know what to heal in the process. And how do you know what to heal? You've got to spend time by yourself. Well, why do people not spend time by themselves? When they spend time by themselves, it's uncomfortable because they think about all this shit. Their mind goes busy and they don't like to think about it. They'd rather be distracted by being around other people. And so the reason I got the lessons that I've got that I'm able to share now is because I'm just someone that's had and still continues. I've had an enormous amount of trauma, and I've had an enormous amount of personal issues, health issues. I've got a very complex, I've had a stroke, two pulmonary embolisms, a hole in my heart. I've had heart ablations for Wolf Parkinson's White. I'm just a complex individual, but I don't say that to go, oh, poor me. I say that because as you start to hear, like when someone sits down in front of me and goes, oh, I really can't change. I'm like, dude, let me tell you my fucking story. And then you tell me if you can't change. I still haven't even told you everything. And, for me, and it's not about who's got the baddest story. It's about, what are we able to do with that? Because if you were to hear my story, it'd be very easy to hear a story like I've got and be talking to a homeless person. You go, man, I really understand why you are where you are. Dude, your potential stepdad was murdered at the age of 8. You nearly died at 15. You were ADHD. You failed every single subject. You were told you were stupid. You've been stabbed. You've been shot at. You've had guns put in your mouth. You've got complex PTSD. You've been exposed to extreme levels of violence. You've almost died another 6 times that we haven't even discussed about. Man, no wonder you are so fucked up. No wonder you live on the street. I get it. But no, man, I'm not. I'm not living on the street. I live in a beautiful house. I've got a beautiful family, and I'm affecting millions of people around the world.
You're living next to Chris Hemsworth is what you're
saying. Chris Hemsworth. But this is, and I think this is why my message resonates with so many people, and this is why I can talk to so many different things, because I'm not a textbook, man. I'm not an academic. I'm a fucking soldier. And what I mean by that is I've been in the trenches. I know what it's like to be, to feel stupid. I know what it's like to feel failure. I know what it's like to be intimidated and be afraid and, be dominated with violence or physical abuse or mental abuse or emotion. I've experienced it. And I think when you've got that level of experience and you can talk about it, it gives you, it gives you a relativity. It gives you a relatability that is different to someone who's just gone and done a degree or someone who's amassed an enormous amount of knowledge through, reading books and doing personal development. And I've met that many coaches out there that know the work, but they haven't done the fucking work because they've come on a blank canvas. And I mean no disrespect to that. Yeah. And I actually interviewed Steve Kotler the other day. And you know Steve Kotler?
Oh, I'm very familiar with Steve Kotler. Yeah, yeah.
He's the god, as far as I'm concerned, he's like the modern day godfather of peak performance.
Yeah. He's the fucking man.
He's the fucking man. He's got a great book out. If you haven't read it, you should. It's called The Art of Impossible. When I was interviewing him, and I've interviewed him a couple times now, one of the things that he found really interesting was the correlation. When he was covering the X Games, he found there's a very strong correlation between these people that were doing what was impossible, considered to be impossible, at 11 a.m. in the morning, on the slopes. And then by 3 p.m., they were breaking through what was done that morning. And so there's, he was following people all over the world that were doing impossible things in a range of different sports and then constantly iterating on that impossibility. And what he discovered was literally, and I'm maybe making these statistics up, but it was a very high percentage, like 98% of those people all came from troubled backgrounds. They came from abusive, addiction, alcoholic, they came from troubled, what would be considered troubled backgrounds. Yet now these guys are at the forefront and the cutting edge of peak performance. And
of humankind in a lot of ways, man.
Human potential. We talk really about human performance, being able to do some of this shit at scale. And there's maybe 1 or 2% of those people that perform at that level that have come from good backgrounds. Everyone else has got a fucking story. And, that speaks volumes to the grittiness that's required to be at the cutting edge of any kind of professional sport. You've got to be able to, I even asked him this question. He couldn't answer it because he likes to be very, he couldn't answer it definitively because he likes to have research and data to back everything up. But my question was, what is it about these kids, these people that enabled them to go from these backgrounds and perform at such high levels in sport? And he goes, well, there's a number of variables. And I said, well, what about the variable of resilience that's been developed by growing up in a highly stressful, highly stressful, highly geared environment to the point where you just get used to stress. You get used to threat. Feeling unsafe, that's just fucking Tuesday, And then all of a sudden you're out in the ski field, you're out in the skate park, you're on a wave and you're like, what the fuck is this? You should have seen my dad. You should have seen my mom. You should have seen my uncle. Like, man, this is Tuesday. And, so I think a lot is to be said for, the experience and the experience that comes from being able to share that experience.
So what a beautifully, beautifully strung together answer. I'm glad that I asked. And then I'll double click on it. So for me, my brain sorts out in a way where I say, okay, well, that was your pass. And God, man, I maybe should have chosen my wording more carefully, because I don't feel in my heart like, and don't take this the wrong way, I feel an immense amount of compassion and love for you, but I don't feel sorry for you. And I don't think you want me to feel sorry for you. I'm like, damn, man, that motherfucker's a soldier, dude. Like, that resonated deep. But I commend you for it, man. Damn, like, that was just beautiful. What I'll say is that even at that reach, and this is why I say I think it's a lot in my head and very little in my heart. And I actually see my friends get caught up in this, because every now and again, I know you know it, you get a glimpse to the truth, and then it requires courage to like bear with that level of uncertainty, to walk into that darkness, but to know that there's light at the end. It's just like taking that next step. But it almost feels like those lessons that you've learned in your life that have come from incredibly deep hardship. And by the way, I think we have, I just want to be clear. I think that we have an hour on the books, but I want to be respectful of your time. That's correct. Okay, cool. Yeah. But that all to me feels like, okay, that's the past. And I discount zero of the lessons that have come from that. And by the way, one of the things that resonated with me deeply about what you just said, that whole soliloquy, was that, it's when I said real recognize real, man, because you're a real fucking dude. Like, all this shit, you can tell. I have a friend who I met at Tony Robbins, funnily enough, when I went years ago, and his name is Kavan, and he grew up in Indianapolis. He was selling guns and illegal drugs to the deepest gangs in Chicago, like the hardest parts of the country. And he one night got caught up in a fight and he got shot right here. And it was 1 centimeter away from killing him. It went in this side, it came out the other. In that deathbed, he found God. And then after that, he went to prison. So he went to jail for a year, and then he was on house arrest. He was a minor. And on house arrest, he said he had nothing to do but watch YouTube videos. Found this fucking dude named Tony Robbins. I'd never heard of him in his life. He was making 6 figures. He had 6 figures in just cash. He was like from the hood. He just had six, and the cops seized all of his assets, all of his drugs, all of his guns. The only thing they didn't seize, because they didn't see value in it, was his fucking Jordan collection. He had like this unbelievable collection of J's. It was like 50 to 100 exclusive Jordans. So he said, fuck it, I'm just going to sell these because all my friends want them. So he sold 50 out of his 60 pairs, as many as he could move. And it was just enough money to buy the $5,000 ticket to go to Tony. Went to Tony in his car, called his lawyer, said, hey, I'm in my car. I am violating house arrest. I'm doing this for me. I got to go change my life. If they show up at my door and the cops show up, I'll happily go back to jail. But if I don't do this, something's going to happen. So he went, and his lawyer said, all right, man, I can't do anything about it. You're in the car. I don't advise you to do it. He went, and then him and I met, and I let him stay in my hotel room. I didn't want him sleeping in his car. He's a good kid. And he went on to found his own company. He got investment from Tony and Bill Gross and some other billionaires, and he's well on his way. But the interesting thing about Kavan is that whenever I call him, I'll just holler at him from time to time, and we'll just chop it up, and I'll be like, hey, man, let me get your thought on this. And I'll have asked probably 10 different friends before Kavan, and then he'll just give me some random answer that's usually poorly fucking worded. No offense, Kavan. He's not like the most well-spoken person on the planet. And he knows that. And I love that about him. And it'll just be like so real. It'll hit me in my core because he's real. What he's been through is so real. So you're incredibly well spoken, but what you say is just so real and honest. So I love that part about you. And my question is this: when you have that life experience, and I recognize that it bears fruits that you can then share with other people. But when you have that life experience, how do you make it so that your life is a constant engagement with lessons, so that you have lessons coming in? Because at some point, I've always mentally thought, well, as much lessons that I have at 25, there's a cap. And how do I continue the lesson category? And I can see
live.
I can see you laughing because I know I'm bullshitting you. So let's call it out. Let's call it how it is.
There's no cap. You stop learning when you die, brother. And so for me, and that's why experience is so important. You know, if you're not living, you're not learning. And, you know, most people are tiptoeing through life trying to get to death safely because they're trying to protect themselves from things that they're afraid of. Mate, there's a great song, and one of the lines from that song is, you know, do one thing every day that scares you. And I would go as far as to say there was times in my life, like I'm very obsessive. Anyone who knows me well knows I am a fucking obsessive. You know, and whether I'm, you know, I'm obsessing about, you know, losing weight or sport or, you know, a video game, I'm just obsessive. But the one thing that has been consistent through my whole life is I was afraid. I was afraid from a very early age. And I remember being afraid. I remember being very wound up and very afraid from a very early age. And I remember being debilitated by it. But just constantly thinking there's got to be a better way. And I remember used to look at kids around me and go, man, why does everyone look so fucking relaxed? I feel like a spring that is completely wound up here. And so what I discovered was my catharsis, my healing was in chasing fear. And it wasn't so much about the desire to becoming, you know, fearless, you know, because, and again, it's not even about removing fear, because even being fearless, you know, is having less fear. It's about having the capabilities and the coherency and, you know, more than anything, the capability to be able to function in fear, because most people can't. And so I've obsessively chased things that fear. Whenever I find something that scares me, I fucking chase it. I found out I had a fear of heights, did 200 skydives in 12 months. You know, I was obsessive with the way I chase those things. And so for me, the way I continually learn, and it's interesting because you asked this at a time now with this is probably the first time in my life, the last 6 weeks in my life has been a little bit challenging, because I got to the point, maybe even longer, I got to the point where I was bored, you know. And when I've had a big life, and when I had my stroke at 34, 2009, I remember, because I remember I got given the choice to stay or to go. And I remember I was like, man, I can go, because at that point I'd lived like five lifetimes.
Wow, hold on, you got the choice. Like,
well, it was a spiritual choice, you know. I got given the choice, okay, you can stay or you can go. And I chose, I was like, man, I've lived five lifetimes. I can go. But I didn't do it. I got to go. Take me away. My life is shit. I was like, man, if I have to go, I got nothing to be afraid of. I've got no regrets. I have lived. I have, you know, I'm skidding in sideways at the age of 34. You can take me, God. I'm ready to go. And then literally I woke up. And, you know, I often say my life is like a fucking movie. People who get to know me, and even my filmmakers who get the opportunity to, you know, spend time with me, especially in the real world, they get to go, fuck, man, you just attract the most incredible shit. Like, I just have the most random things that happen. And so for me, the more I put myself out there, the more I get to learn, and
more it comes back. Constant. So then
time.
Go ahead. No. Go ahead. Please.
Well, what I was going to say, since COVID, I haven't been getting out as much, you know, I haven't been living as much. And I got to the point where after last year, the only thing I was doing was being a parent and working, and that was, and you know, and that was it. I had family and I had work. And then at the end of the last year, I was just like, man, I'm fucking done. I don't even know if I want to do this anymore. And what had happened was I just got bored. And the reason I got bored is because there was no adventure in my life. I wasn't learning. I wasn't exposing myself to things that were I was afraid of. Going through Corona, and we're about to release an incredible documentary series called Bracing for Impact. You know, we were well ahead of the game. And the beginning of Corona, I was in my element. Why? Because the whole world was falling apart. And that's when I'm at my best. But once everything kind of went into lockdown, man, I got bored. And so like everyone else, I got my things to do. I got my work to do. And right now my work is to find things that scare me, do one thing every day that scares me, and yeah, learn every single day as much as I possibly can.
That's a beautiful North Star, man. And I'm very excited for the series, by the way. Here's my final kind of note on the subject. Do you do it? Here's a beautiful distinction. Do you, and I know the answer, but I almost want to hear you say it. At least I think I know the answer, which is, do you do those things that scare you because they're for you, and you, and enjoy them is the wrong word, but what I mean is the energy of the word enjoyment is, do you do them because it's for you, or do you do them so that you can go teach other people about them?
Both. But first and foremost, I do it for me. I used to do scary things because I was afraid. Now I do scary things because I can. And I get, it is like even jumping out of a plane. I don't know if you've ever skydived before. Like, I was an avid skydiver. I used to free fly. So when I would skydive, most of the jumps I did was solo. I did some, you know, formation work, but you know, most people would fly flat fly. You know, when I fly, I'm head down. So I'm like, you know, if you're flat fly, you're doing like 220 kilometers an hour. And I'm not sure what that is in
no, miles. I'm in Canada. So I'm on.
When I would jump, like most of my jumps, if I wasn't meditating in free fall, I was doing what's called head down. And so head down, you're going like 300 Ks an hour. And so, and not a lot of people enjoyed it because it was, you know, some people would do it, but most people would avoid that stuff because it was a little bit scary. But I like to do it. Number one, it was scary, but I like to do it to the point where I could do it, not because I was no longer doing it to overcome a fear, because it's like, man, I can do it. And then the surge of adrenaline, like I nearly died a couple of days. Well, one particular time skydiving, I had a series of malfunctions, and you know, the mistake that I made, because I'm so obsessed with chasing fear, or I was so much more then. Since I've had my son, I have mellowed a little bit, but I would do this thing called smoking low. And so when you are, you know, a, you know, following the rules and the regulations of normal, you know, accelerated free fall, you will deploy your pilot chute and you'll deploy your chute at, you know, between four and a half thousand feet. Not me. You know, I used to run with some cowboys and we would normally deploy our parachutes at around 2,500 feet, you know, sometimes 2,000 feet. Why? Because between 4,500 feet and 2,000 feet, you get this thing called ground rush, where, you know, if you're falling through the sky, everything looks really small from 14,000 feet. And then once you get to like 4,000 feet, everything starts to get a little bit bigger. But between 4,000 feet and 2,000 feet, everything gets big real fast. And you get what's called ground rush. And ground rush is one of the most addictive things to skydive. But the reason that you don't deploy at 2,000 or 2,500 feet is because if you have a malfunction, you've got half the time to correct it. And one of the reasons you're supposed to deploy at 4,500, 5,000 feet is because if you have a malfunction, you've got a few seconds to be able to, you know, work it out or, you know, release the main and deploy the reserve. Whereas at 2,000 feet, if you have a malfunction, you know, you're barely going to be able to release your main chute. And because when you're, if you've got a severe malfunction, you know, you've got two handles on your pack and you've got a padded handle, which you pull and that will release your main. And you normally have to pull that handle, release your main and get the, all the cables clear before you pull your reserve because your reserve is sprung loaded. And if that thing punches out while your main is still there, it gets tied up in your main. You get what's called gift wrap and you fall to the ground and you're baked, right? And so one day I had this severe malfunction at I smoked it at 2,200 feet and I worked out I had a severe malfunction and I tried to get out of the malfunction. By the time I got out of the malfunction, I realized I couldn't. I was at about 1,200 feet and heading towards 1,000 feet. If you deploy below 1,000 feet, you're going to break something pretty badly. And so I knew it takes at least 3 seconds to, you know, to 5 seconds to release your main. And I was like, man, I don't have the time. You know, and so as a result, I had to do what's called the gunslinger where you grab both paddles at the same time. And you pull them both at the same time and you pray to God that your main releases in time and that your sprung loaded reserve pilot doesn't just ejaculate into the main and it becomes all fucking wrapped up and you become gift wrapped. And sure enough, I was very lucky. I did the gunslinger. I pulled it out and I came crashing into the ground so hard that not only did I knock the wind, I thought I'd broken my hip. I thought I'd broken something. I was winded. I couldn't fucking move. But it took me a few seconds to find myself. And then I rolled over and I had a stick. I'm talking a stick like as thick as this finger jammed into my shin bone and sticking out by about this far. And it was like twang. And so for me, I've learned, you know, that the more I chase fear, and by the way, fear is an incredible obsession that I have chased. But there's got to be a boundary between what's a rational obsession or a rational fear and an irrational fear. And so for me, yeah, I found myself in situations before like that one where I've just pushed the envelope a little bit too far because I could. Well, at the end of the day, it gave me a great story to tell, but it nearly cost me my life.
Damn, man, you are a fucking crazy man, dude. But that's insane. A stick was sticking through your shin?
It was through my jumpsuit into my shin and I walked in because it was jammed into my shin and like we videoed it and you know, it was like, imagine the pen sticking to my shin. It was like twang, twang. Dude, we had to get it and we had to like pull this thing out. And I've got this hole in my shin bone now. I've got this scar that you can feel. It's like there's a hole in my shin bone.
Wait, hold on. Sorry. It was through the bone? It was through the bone, not your skin?
It didn't go all the way through the bone. It was sent through the skin. It was into the bone. Like it was jammed into the bone. I've got like a nice big divot in my bone that I can feel.
Dude,
from here.
That is
like the one I've got in my head up here. I got hit.
Yeah, I was actually able to see it a bit on screen. Dude, that's, wow. I can't believe that. That's amazing. Yeah, I'm not amazing, but that's just gnarly. Okay, cool. Let's wrap out on the next 10, but this one I think is going to help a lot of people. And this is completely off topic. Thanks for being with me on that line of questioning though. You answered it really well. One of the things that has impacted me the most is when and it always happens because I stumble across it, is I receive a model of the world, meaning a model of the world to help me usually understand my pain and my own challenges, and then be able to through that model create meaning of the situation. And then another word for meaning in this situation is I'm able to find the lesson and the blessing in whatever it is that's painful in my life, be it the failure or the shortcoming or whatever the case may be. I've read a lot of models. I've learned a lot of models. I've stumbled across a lot of models, but I've always found that it's the models that help change my life because They're with me whenever I'm not with the book. They're with me whenever I'm not at the seminar. They're with me whenever I'm not with that person or relying on them. Do you have a model that you help encourage people to use to assess the painful situations in their life? Almost.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, for me, it's based on the laws of duality. Like, we live in a dual world. We live in a world that at the atomic level is made up of equal parts of positive charge and equal parts of negative charge. And those two forces, those two energies come together in orbit, and they vibrate at a level of frequency depending on what we're looking at to give the appearance of this world that we have. But there's no aspect of this world that is separate from that phenomena of equal parts of positive charge and equal parts of negative charge. And experience is exactly the same. You know, we can be quite, I guess you could say, arrogant in assuming that things are good and bad because we look at them in isolation based on this human concept called time. But what we can't see is, you know, our 1 year of a bad life is less than a split fraction of a second in, you know, the billion years, the 8 billion years that this universe has been alive. And so what we don't often always see is we don't always see the big picture. And so where I'm going with this is a little concept you're probably familiar with, Nick, it's called hindsight. And have you ever had something in your life that's happened to you and you've gone, oh my God, this is terrible. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I just wish this had never happened. And then sure enough, 6 months, you know, maybe 2 years, 6 years, but 6 years later, you look back and you go, fuck, man, you know what? I'm actually really glad that happened, because if not for that happening, I wouldn't be where I am now. And have you ever Absolutely. Had that happen before?
Absolutely.
Everybody has. And yeah. That's why we call it hindsight. You know, whereas for me, I've got this model whereby it's like, how do we introduce hindsight into the moment? How do we look at the divinity, you know, the equanimity that is there, that our psychology is biased against in most cases seeing, because we're addicted to this pain pleasure concept. You know, we're addicted to looking at things, oh my God, that's amazing, so that we can feel good. And we're addicted to saying things, oh my God, that's terrible, so that we can feel bad. And you know, both of those emotions are, you know, just as addictive as drugs and narcotics. And you know, people often swing between wanting to label things as good as and bad, because it gives them, you know, a bit more richness to the experience we call life. But what I like to do is I like to look at things in harmony. And to me, you know, the way if we can look at life through the lens of love, and love to me is a synthesis of complementary opposites seen in synchronicity. And so, you know, depending on what work you've done and, you know, the events that you've done, you go, we're surrounded by this, you know, this force of love. You know, there's so much love around us, but it's not this Disneyland love. It's this love of this concept of two forces that have come together that are working synchronously. And so for me, whenever a bad thing happens, I force myself to ask this question, what is the benefit of this? There is no benefit. It's terrible. Keep asking till you get one, because it's there. You're just not willing to look at it, okay? Because you may be too emotional, okay? Or you're too stressed, or you're too in the moment. Well, first of all, regulate the emotion, okay? Regulate the stress so that you can get yourself back to neutral, and then answer the question, what's the benefit of this? And keep answering that question till you have a stack, okay? And then move to the next question. What skills, knowledge, and experience have I gained from this that's going to make me better, sharper, faster, stronger tomorrow than I am today? And if you sit there and you ask those questions, and normally, I've worked with people that have had all sorts of, you know, some of the most horrible things that have happened to them. And at first they want to fight and say, there's no benefit, there's no skills, there's no knowledge. But if you sit there and you ask and you have the patience and you can stay in your heart and you can hold the space for someone, they'll be able to go to that place where that horrible traumatic thing, and they go, well, you know what? There was a benefit. Okay. And there was some skills, there was some knowledge, there was some experience, there was some wisdom that's gained. And you know what? When you stack all the benefits, when you stack all the skills, when you stack all the wisdom, when you stack all the knowledge, and then you look at it, and then you look at it in that experience and go, okay, would you now take that experience away? Most people I do that with would go, no way. They go, I never saw it like that before, because it was imbalanced. And duality, the law of duality is there is equal parts of positive and equal parts of negative charge in every aspect of matter, but it also goes up to experience. Every experience is both good or bad, but if you have bias, you're going to experience pain. And if you have continued bias and you hold on to bias, you're going to have suffering. You know, and Buddha said himself, life is painful. Suffering is optional. That's one thing to have a sore back, Nick, but it's another thing to bitch about it every 3 minutes.
Completely.
What we pay attention to expands. You know, paying attention is the price for the experience that we have. And if you pay attention to bad things, that's what you're paying to expand. And as a result, your life will be expanded and surrounded in things that are perceived to be bad. If you pay attention to good things, those things will expand. If you pay attention to both sides of the equation, you'll live in truth. And you'll know that everything that happens is both good and bad. It's never one or the other. Okay. And if you want to be a happy-go-lucky person, fine. By all means, live there, because at some point someone's going to knock you off that pedestal when something perceivably bad happens. But if you want your life to be all bad and dramatic because it gets you a lot of attention, okay, that's fine. And sooner or later, you're going to have aspects where you're going to get excited about different pieces. But if you can see both simultaneously, where you can see the synchronous of complementary opposites working, if you can see the complementary of the synthesis of complementary opposites working in synchronicity, now you have perspective, because you can see the good in everyone and you can see the bad in everyone, and you can still be accepting rather than just trying to focus on the good and ignoring the bad. Okay. Or rather than just focusing on the bad and ignoring the good, see the both, see both people. That's what, you know, that's a level of unconditional love for life. That's a level of unconditional life for self. You know, that's a level of unconditional life for others that most people aren't willing to go to or aren't able to go to. And the first person we need to start with when we look at this hindsight model is ourselves, because how many people are judging themselves as being good or bad based on their own experiences? Whereas if we can look at our light and our dark in synchronous and go, wow, I've got some really good qualities, I've got some really bad qualities. Okay, well, maybe I need to manage the way I express those bad qualities so that there's less impact. Maybe I need to manage those good qualities in a way where I become less taken advantage of. Maybe if I can see them both, you know, in synchronicity, those complementary opposites, maybe I can actually be more accepting of myself. And if I can be more accepting of myself, maybe I can be more accepting of my brother, of my sister, of my partner. Because you know what? They've got good parts and they've got bad parts.
What a model, man. Damn. That was a beautiful answer. And just a tag along that I'll ask you as like a very short snippet on that. If you're meant to see the world in a loving way, so to speak, for lack of a better way to put it, for time, and then there's this balance of synchronicity, do you believe, and I've struggled with this, that you should also see the world, and this is, it's dark, but I don't see the world this way. It's just, I've asked myself the question, do you believe because there's synchronicity and there's equanimity, do you believe as much as we should see it lovingly, we should always also see it, again, harsh word, but almost hatefully, so that we can balance out the opposite? I'm curious as to how you feel on this.
To me, lovingly contains both aspects.
Wow.
To me.
Wow.
To
okay.
me, lovingly.
Can you explain that? I would
love. How can you love something without seeing its darkness? Because you're going, no, I only love the good part of you. Just leave those bad parts behind, whether it be a dog or a person or a situation. Love. You want to talk about love? Let's stop fucking looking at Disneyland. Let's stop looking at, you know, romance novels and start looking at the reality of life. You know, when a tree falls in the forest, do all the trees sit around there going, oh, Frank died. Oh my God, that was terrible. Oh, Frank was such a good tree. He provided so much shade to so many people. He recycled the nutrients so well. No, they don't do anything because they understand that that is the balance of life. When a tree falls in the forest, there is no sadness. Okay, there is a recomposition, a recycling of life. And it just is. You know, whereas when good or bad things happen, we have this ego, this psychology that's governed by this ego that wants to label things, because we like to label things in order to create meanings. We're meaning machines. Whereas in reality, you know, the true meaning of life is to experience love, right? And love is both sides. How can you truly love something if you can't accept both sides? That's not love. That's fucking, what's it called? Infatuation. Infatuation is when you only love one aspect. How many times have you known someone that's gotten a relationship with another human being? They go, oh my God, this is the best person I've ever been with in my life. You know, what do you, anything you know about them? No, there's everything I love. And they, even when they sleep, their nose whistles when they sleep. I just love the way their nose whistles when they sleep. And then like 6 years later, like they're sitting there with a pillow thinking about fucking suffocating them every time they sleep because their nose is whistling, right? What happens in unbalanced love is we fall in love, or we choose to only focus on the positive parts of another human being or an experience. But what happens is over time, we can't ignore the other side, the equal and opposite side. And it builds up and it builds up and it builds up and it builds up. And then all of a sudden, that's all we see. We no longer see the loving parts. We just see all the parts of that person that we no longer like. And that builds what we call resentment. And then once resentment enters relationship, it's toast. Whereas imagine a world where we could actually sit down with people, you know, in the beginning of a relationship and say, so what are all your good parts? And people would tell it, and they go, what are all your bad parts? And people could openly and honestly share that stuff. You know, it was like the partner I'm with right now. When we literally first started dating, we went on our first date. I said, there are some things you need to know about me. I have complex PTSD. I have a history of addiction. I have a very traumatic, you know, I've got a trauma profile that, you know, most people wouldn't, you know, acquire over 5 lifetimes. And she was just like, what the fuck? But thankfully, she was open enough and aware enough to go, that's really interesting. Tell me more. And I was like, well, here's some stuff you need to know about me. I'm not a normal person. I don't relate in normal ways. You know, I don't communicate normal. I don't have normal standards. You know, I'm an obsessive person. And so I put all my, you know, because, you know, thankfully, because she had known me for a while, she knew all my good parts, but she hadn't had the opportunity to see all my bad parts. I was like, well, hang on, I'm not going to wait, you know, until you know, see these and find these out by accident down the track. Here they are. I'll show them to you. Because if you can't accept me as a whole human being, then we shouldn't be in this relationship. And that sparked a beautiful union. And I just think that should be how, you know, more people relate, is they shouldn't be ashamed of their darkness. They should be embracing their darkness. But most people are ashamed of their darkness because they're ashamed of their darkness. And so then they're ashamed of other people's darkness. And so they see their darkness in other people and they go, well, I don't like that part of me that I see in that person. So I'm going to judge that person the way I judge me. But if you can love you first for your darkness and your light, then it makes loving another person for theirs, you know, a shit ton easier.
That spoke to me in ways that are very tough to put into words, man. That was so beautifully said and just really touched my whole heart. I want to close out here because we're a little bit over time and I appreciate you. I'm pulling out my phone because I'm going to read to you something that I read last night that reminded me of you that I was like, you know what? Let me read this to Kerwin and then I'll say, what are your closing thoughts on this? So I'm going to read it. It's from one of my favorite books, which is called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. I'm sure you've read it.
Right,
but it says, more and more, a psychiatrist is approached today by patients who confront him with human problems rather than neurotic problems. Some of the people who nowadays call on a psychiatrist would have seen a pastor, priest, or rabbi in former days. Now they often refuse to be handed over to a clergyman and instead confront the doctor with questions such as, what is the meaning of my life? That said, what do you feel people are missing these days, Kerwin?
Look, I think it'd be pretty arrogant for me to assume that I knew the answer to that question. But if I was going to take a roaring guess, it would be purpose. Like, people are missing purpose. Like, people think the purpose of life is to get up, go to work, come home, eat, do it again, buy things that they don't need to impress people they don't like, and, you know, consume more things. But to me, I think if we can all get clear on why we're here, you know, this is the cool thing about nature. Nature doesn't sit there and think, you know, a tree doesn't sit there and go, fuck, man, what's my purpose? It just lives its purpose, right? An ant doesn't sit there and go, man, what's my purpose? It just lives its purpose. And by virtue of nature living its purpose, there's a balance, right? Nature is in balance. Why? Because it does what nature does. It's on purpose. Humans, you know, we could look at every form of dysfunction and say, why? Because we've lost our purpose. We've lost our way. And I don't think we've lost our way. I think we're coming back. I think we're coming back. People are finding their way. People are finding their North Star. But if you look at, you know, the state of politics, if you look at the state of climate, if you look at the state of the union, all this imbalance is because people have gone, well, what's my purpose? To make money. Well, okay, do whatever it takes to make money. Lie, cheat, steal, cut things down. You know, wipe out entire ecosystems, wipe out species of animals. As long as you're making money, because if that's your purpose, everything else doesn't matter. Whereas if your purpose is to live sustainably, if your purpose is to live collaboratively, if your purpose is to live harmoniously, which I believe once you take, you know, many aspects of what we've been conditioned to believe are why we're here out, then sustainability is no longer something that we strive for. It just happens naturally. Now, the nature doesn't strive for sustainability. It just is sustainable. Humans come in and fuck it up because they have these ambitions that are beyond just maintaining a sustainable environment. Why? Because they live on a lack economics. More, 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 and we have to take in order to build. Whereas wow. If we look at, you know, Salim Ismail, you know, he's an incredible man. He talks about abundant economics, where we start looking at the abundant. How do we live in a way where there's an abundance of everything? And nature does it already. Why can't we do the same?
Beautiful answer. Wrapping out question. What's something you're grateful for and why, Kerwin?
My son. Every single day, I am grateful to be able to look in his eyes and see the potential of humanity. You know, he's the most important. He's my number one client. He's the greatest client I've ever had. He's the greatest project I've ever had. And, you know, maybe that sounds a little bit contrite, but when I look at my son, I see hope.
That's beautiful.
And I'm grateful for that.
That's beautiful, man. That's really beautiful. Kerwin, man, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, man, for being on. It was a long time coming. I know I DM'd you a while ago and I was so surprised and we did some follow-ups and then eventually I was like, you know what? Let it just be with God and your team re-redirect around and re-reached around to my surprise, and I was just so beautifully gifted. So man, I don't take this stuff lightly, man. Thanks so much for being on. Thank you for your time. Thanks for helping. Thanks for loving.